Friday in the 3 o'clock hour, of course, is the Federal News Countdown. Today's no exception, and I have a terrific panel of experts who have chosen their three most important federal news stories of the week on the Federal News Countdown. Today, it's former Deputy OFPP Administrator, now with the venerable law firm Rob Burton. It's great to see you, my friend. Thanks for coming in.
It's great to see you.
And Julie Myers-Wood, former head of ICE, and now with INC Solutions. And Julie as well, it's nice to see you.
Great to see you, Francis.
And congratulations on the big announcement since I've seen you last.
You're with
child, and you're going to have, when are you going to add to your family?
The end of August, we're having a little girl, so we're very excited about that.
Congratulations. That's wonderful news, and it's great to see you. It is great to be able to count down the three most important federal news stories of the week with both of you, and we start, as we always do, with...
Number three!
Rob Burton, your third most important federal news story of the week is from Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller. House Committee passes data transparency bill. This is just step one of the Data Act, but it appears that this is something that could actually go somewhere since there is a companion bill in the Senate that Senator Mark Warner is pushing. What is it that you saw in this story that you thought was particularly noteworthy?
Well, first of all, it passed unanimously, which is pretty noteworthy, which I think what that means, Francis, is, it's coming here. I just think this is a huge theme in the government. You know, the government's been trying to get its hands around data for how long? And what you're seeing here in this bill is really the institutionalization of the Recovery Board.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I mean, we can debate about whether the stimulus was wise or not, but what I think was good about that whole effort is that the Recovery Board has performed rather well as far as tracking federal spending, and the recovery.gov database, I think, should probably be mirror imaged in a government-wide way. And that's what this legislation does, Francis, and that's why I think it is important, because mm-hmm. I do think it's going to pass. I think it does have bipartisan support, and I think that some of the best practices that the Recovery Board has utilized probably should be transplanted government-wide. One thing I saw when I was with the government, that data management was one of the biggest challenges government have. They just can't seem to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, there's a lot of data.
Yeah.
But the government doesn't do it well, and I do believe that by sort of trying to institutionalize the best practices that the Recovery Board has utilized with respect to data management and tracking federal spending, probably not a bad idea, and that's what this legislation is going to do.
But Rob, does this have new FTEs for the government agencies who are going to have to try to make sure all this data is transparently managed and put out there in a fair and appropriate way?
Yeah, well, Julie, this is one of those. It's called an unfunded requirement.
I've heard of those.
That's what I thought, but I guess I just, you know, this being in the private sector and certainly as an American citizen, this is exactly the kind of thing you want to see, is you want to have this kind of transparency and make sure that you can get at kind of the fraud and the waste. But for our overwhelmed and overworked procurement officials, you know, what kind of burden is this going to place on them?
Well, you know, quite frankly, Julie, I think what this is going to do is just keep everybody on the Recovery Board on the payroll. You know, for as far as I can tell, this is basically taking the Recovery Board and calling it something else. Mm-hmm. It's going to have some real fancy title. It's got a lot of words in it. It's going to be the FAST Board. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, we'll have a new acronym. That's the first thing this legislation does. It gives us a new acronym.
Federal Accountability and Spending Transparency Board.
There you go.
Is what that stands for.
There you go. So I think it's basically the Recovery Board with full employment.
What I think is interesting about this is something that we've seen throughout this administration, which is the willingness to say, this thing is working, and we're going to copy it and just do it someplace else rather than try to reinvent the wheel. And I think there's something to be said for that. There's been a tendency in the past, Julie, we've talked about this off the air, to look at things and try and go, well, that's working there. How can we completely remanufacture something different and start over and try to achieve the same goal as this successful way of doing things? I think that's a wise idea, even if it's just renaming something that already exists.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, if some members of Congress feel they can get extra credit by creating a new acronym, mm-hmm. but not actually, you know, kind of reinventing the wheel, I think that's terrific and can really move the ball forward, so long as it doesn't kind of make the folks in the agencies have a bunch of extra work. So it's very reassuring to hear that from Rob.
Well, you know, actually, who's going to have more work are the contractors. There are going to be a lot of reporting requirements flowing down to subcontractors and subcontractors, they're going to have definitely more work under this law.
Well, I mentioned the companion bill in the Senate is sponsored by Senator Mark Warner, and I'm going to talk to him about that bill on Tuesday's show. So we'll find out more from the Senate side on how that will work. Rob Burton's story number three on the countdown is from Federal News Radio's Jason Miller. House committee passes data transparency bill. Julie, your story number three is from the New York Times. The headline is My Life as an Undocumented Immigrant. And the irony here, I thought, was this gentleman who came out as an undocumented, an illegal immigrant, used to work for the Washington Post, and we found out later the Washington Post turned the story down, decided not to do it, and he took it to the New York Times, and the Times ran it. What was the most significant thing about this to you?
Well, I think it's interesting to see how the Washington Post actually knew that this individual was illegal and continued to employ him for a number of years. And often there's a stereotype that hiring of illegal workers only happens in certain kinds of industries, so that you only have to pay attention to the meat industry or the hospitality industry. But I think this story shows that even in white-collar industries, you can have companies that are very lax about the I-9 requirements that accept just copies of documents rather than the originals that are required by the I-9 process. I also think this story does a good job of showing the compelling case that he has for staying in the country. And, you know, I think there are probably 11 million compelling cases, but it's nice to see kind of another side of the story, somebody who's come here at a young age, kind of worked really hard, and then all that he had to do to kind of subvert the law. All the people that tried to help him get driver's licenses that were not shouldn't have been issued to him, and also help him get a job, even though he wasn't entitled to work. So it kind of shows, I think, overall our system's broken, and then shows that there are companies that are complicit that we wouldn't normally think of companies that would be complicit.
In the grand scheme of things, is this has been painted a couple of different ways. This has been painted as a success story. This person's overcome adversity and so on and so forth. It's also been painted as a series of failures and almost subversiveness, because there are the entities that you talked about that were willing to look the other way, knowing that lawbreaking was going on. Where do you come down on that spectrum, one or the other, or somewhere in between, or neither?
I think it's really both. I think it shows kind of individual, you know, triumph kind of over adversity and doing things to kind of try to succeed. And certainly we can all understand kind of what a horrible circumstance he was in and how he needed to kind of move along. But it also shows kind of how our system is broken and sometimes coddles people that are here that maybe shouldn't be here. And who I really feel sorry for are the parents in other countries that are thinking about, should I send my child across the border or overseas with a coyote, or should I wait in line until I can get in legally?
Yeah.
And I think the problem with this story is what sort of incentives are we going to give? Are we going to encourage people to send their kids over with coyotes? In this instance, Mr. Vargas was so lucky. He had these wonderful grandparents who took great care of him. He had teachers that looked out for him. Not every kid has that. Often when they come over with a coyote, they can be bribed. They can be put into trafficking. All sorts of horrible things can happen. So, I do think overall the big result of the story for me is this system is broken. We've got to address it. And we really shouldn't be addressing it on a person by person. We really should look more comprehensively at how we can change the system.
As I read this, I thought of six different stereotypes, and I'm not going to go into all of them now, but I thought of six different stereotypes about the illegal immigration situation that this story just completely punctures.
That's exactly right. He does a brilliant job, such a gifted writer, does a really brilliant job of kind of breaking down some of those traditional stereotypes. And, I know, because I work with companies every day, that they're untrue, but a lot of people kind of out on the street don't realize that. And so I think he's made the journey of people who are here illegally a lot more accessible and understandable to the average American.
My Life as an Undocumented Immigrant is Julie Myers Wood's story number three on the Federal News Countdown this week on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. The in-depth page on federalnewsradio.com has all the stories that we're counting down today posted there, so you can follow along as we continue with story number two in just a moment from Rob Burton and Julie Myers Wood. It's the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
While the wheel was being invented, prehistoric man probably took a snack break. And today, we still grab a little something-something to tide us over when we're on the job. Something sweet or salty or fatty. Unfortunately, those snacks often end up lowering our energy level. and a poor diet can increase our weight while decreasing our ability to work effectively. At Kaiser Permanente, we just think the work snack needs updating. Say, fruit bowls and veggie plates at meetings, or putting locale choices in the vending machines, even lunchtime trips to local farmers markets. It's total health thinking. That's what Kaiser Permanente does for employers that choose us. Provides tools for companies to keep employees healthy and productive. Find out how a Kaiser Permanente plan can help your employees and your business thrive. Go to kp.org/thrive9to5.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
The Government IT Solutions Spotlight is brought to you by CDWG.
The General Services Administration is testing a new approach with 70 vendors to speed up offers and contract modifications under the federal supply schedule. GSA has long discussed the idea of e-offers and e-modifications. Under this pilot, vendors are working out the bugs of the new systems. Patricia Waddell is GSA's Deputy Director for Schedule 70. She says GSA will expand the pilot to other vendors later this year and plans to take the e-offers and e-modification systems live in 2012.
If you're in federal IT, you know the pressure to maximize your agency's IT investment. Visit cdwg.com/datacenter to see how our experts have helped federal agencies virtualize, optimize, consolidate their data centers, and reduce ROI pressure. CDWG, people who get it.
Visit cdwg.com to learn how you can achieve the benefits of private clouds with a VCE V-Block solution from EMC, Cisco, and VMware.
Fears about breast cancer. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. Whether breast cancer will return is something worth worrying about, but researchers say some survivors worry more than others. The researchers at the University of Michigan saw this in survey data on more than 1,800 women in Los Angeles and Detroit. Nancy Jan says while some worry about recurrence is understandable, the amount of worry that women reported differed by their race and ethnicity.
Latinas who preferred Spanish tended to worry more about their cancer coming back. African American women worried less.
Jan says survivors need good counseling to help them understand their individual risk. The study in the journal Cancer was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
I'm Amy Morris. Here's a look at Monday morning's Federal Drive. A new interim rule is expected to affect how premiums are calculated for the Federal Employee Health Benefits Plan. We'll tell you what you should be looking for. And the Deputy Postmaster General explains the decision to stop contributions to the Federal Employee Retirement System. That and more Monday morning, starting at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. For all the latest federal news, check us out on federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown with my guest this week, Rob Burton of Venable, Julie Myers Wood of INC Solutions, and Rob Burton, your story number 2. Second most important federal news story of the week is from Federal Computer Week, headlined, Congressman Wants to Halt Insourcing. Congressman Mick Mulvaney of South Carolina wants to limit the amount of insourcing that's going on. In fact, put a moratorium on it until your former organization, OFPP, can bring out its guidance on this topic. Dan Gordon has been talking about this guidance for a fair amount of time, but it's not here yet. And we're back to this whole inherently governmental conversation that's been going on seemingly ever since Al Berman first wrote about it.
Well, I thought this was important because the very fact there was a hearing on this topic, Francis, is what I thought, A, was important, because this is, to my knowledge, this is the first hearing that Congress has had on this topic. And it's a very important topic to small businesses in particular, because there are actually small businesses that have gone out of business because of this initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And it is an initiative. And the guidance that you're talking about, Francis, which the Office of Federal Procurement Policy has been working on now since March of last year, is not mere guidance. This will be regulatory, and it will go into the federal acquisition regulation. The good news is at least eventually there'll be some type of government-wide process. Right now there's nothing. There are no rules. There's no process. There's no transparency. Some of these small businesses that testified talked about having to go through FOIA to get the government cost data.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no competition. And, you know, I've been in this business now, Francis, for over 30 years, and I got to tell you, I do not recall a government initiative in the procurement world that has been so harmful to small businesses and other businesses as well, where there's no competition, no transparency. It goes against every fundamental pillar of our procurement process.
In the discussion, though, about inherently governmental, the idea that we would decide something should be inherently governmental or should not be inherently governmental and therefore open to competition just because small businesses do it and we should provide an opportunity for them kind of seems also contrary to the whole concept of what the government should or shouldn't be doing or how you make that decision.
Well, now, this is interesting, and just to clarify this point, because the congressman, when he started off this hearing, was very clear that we're not talking about inherently governmental. You know, that is really not a debatable point. Everybody agrees if it's inherently governmental, government employees should do it, of course. What we're talking about are commercial functions where the private sector is well suited to do it, and bringing that work in to have government employees do it. To me, and one reason our procurement system is different, the federal procurement system is different than any commercial procurement system, is that we do have public policy goals such as providing opportunities to small business. That is a major public policy goal of our procurement system. And why would you have an initiative that actually is intentionally or unintentionally removing those opportunities from those businesses? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
But in a roundabout way, isn't something deemed to be inherently governmental if a government agency is tasked to do it? I mean, it's a backdoor way of looking at it, I know.
Well, of course, now this was really quite amusing. My understanding is the representative from the union, there was a representative from the union testifying at this particular hearing.
Jackie Simon from AFGE was there, yeah.
Exactly. And the congressman said, well, is there anything that the private sector really should be doing as opposed to government employees? And she really could not answer the question. And then he said, well, what about food services? That's a commercial type function that the government, the private sector can do, right? And she says, well, I don't know. Let me tell you, as far as the VA hospitals are concerned, I think that food services provided to VA hospitals is inherently governmental. This kind of notion is not well-founded. You know, I mean, this part of the problem is this debate about what's inherently governmental, and I think the union representatives would probably argue almost everything is inherently governmental. It's simply not. And there's not like a lot of commercial companies doing inherently governmental work. I'm sure you can find one horror story or maybe even two or three. But the bottom line is most companies are doing commercial work. And one of the objectives we've had, the government has had for decades, is to move commercial type work to the private sector. Mm-hmm. That's actually been a policy goal.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there are particular kinds of small businesses that are most at risk with the potential new guidance that's coming or have already been hurt the most with the movement so far towards insourcing?
Well, that's an interesting question, Julie. You know, and the congressman asked one of the small businesses, why do you think you're being targeted?
Mm-hmm.
And her response was, well, because I have a large number of employees. You know, I don't think it really is so much what kind of work you're doing. It's how many people do you have?
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the objectives here is to move as many people to the federal government as possible. And I don't think it's a mere coincidence, Francis, that we have more federal employees that are union members than ever before in our history, and we have more federal employees than ever before, I think since the Nixon-Ford era.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this initiative is related to that movement.
Mm-hmm. And boy, once you insource something, I mean, when I was at ICE, we were working to outsource things, and that movement is long and hard and really tough, even when it makes a lot of financial sense, as we were doing for a detention facility we were doing for the cafeteria workers, and to try to get that to be a private sector function in a particular government-owned detention facility was something that was a multi-year process,
mm-hmm.
even though it was clear it was going to save a lot of money and be kind of most efficient.
Yeah, and Julie, one thing they focused on in this hearing were cost-based insourcing decisions, where the agency said, it's not inherently governmental, we agree. We think that it will be cheaper for federal employees to do the work. And, of course, here we go again. There's no process, the cost analysis. In one case, the small business testified that she tried to present cost data to the agency, said they had no interest in even looking at it. They had already performed their robust cost analysis, which you have to wonder about.
You sound skeptical to some degree.
I do think that this is not about cost savings. I do think there is the objective is to have more federal employees doing the work that private sector people are currently doing.
But it should be about cost savings because we're facing this, you know, huge kind of debt crisis, and agencies are going to have to be looking and cutting back, and very, you know, tough decisions are going to be made. And so we have to be thinking about how can we be most cost effective and how can we be most flexible, frankly. You know, so if a need changes, if it's a contractor, it's much easier to kind of, you know, move them on out versus if it's a federal FTE, it's a long, very long.
She's absolutely
process.
Right. Yeah, Julie's absolutely right. But I have this real simplistic notion that if you have competition, you will end up with the best value and you will end up with the lowest cost. The fact that we have a process going on here with no competition suggests to me that it probably is going to result in higher costs.
Your favorite cynical radio host, though, says this is coming out of the House. It's sponsored by a Republican. The Senate's Democratic. This isn't going to go anywhere anyway. I mean, this is
is
never going to get out of the Senate. Senator Reid would never even allow this to be tacked onto some other bill.
You mean as far as a moratorium or, you know, something of that nature?
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think what's significant about it is at least it has some airtime now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do think it's important to get this into the press. I do think that it needs to be debated. And one way to do that is through a congressional hearing.
We've already contacted Congressman Mulvaney's office to see if he can come on the show and talk about this and what it means. Rob Burton's story number two in the countdown is from Federal Computer Week. The headline is Congressman Wants to Halt Insourcing, and you can read it and all of the stories on the countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Julie Myers Woods' story number two when we continue with the Federal News Countdown in just a minute.
America. Those words mean a lot. From uniforms to help desk support to office supplies, Ability One employees deliver quality, American-made solutions to our federal government. Ability One creates jobs for people who are blind or have other significant disabilities without relying on taxpayer subsidies. For quality products and services right here at home, contact AbilityOne.org. Because Made in America is more than a label. It's a promise kept to more than 47,000 Americans who are willing and able to work.
Don't miss the first annual Backgammon Beating Cancer Tourney, Saturday, February 26th, to benefit the wellness community, providers of free programs of emotional support, education, and hope for people with cancer and their loved ones. Beginners to experts are welcome. For more information, call David Ogden at 301-717-7166. For more information about the wellness community of Greater Washington, call 301-493-5002. All programs at the wellness community are provided free of charge.
Attention employees of the intelligence community and Department of Defense. Right now, you could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com or call 1-800-826-1126. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102, contract series 83500.
Newsmakers on the Federal Drive.
Postmaster General Patrick Donahoe.
We are going to lose money again this year for two reasons. First of all, just like the economy, our revenue's down. There's economic pressure on us, plus electronic diversion, people paying bills online. And over the last 4 years, we've experienced a 20% drop in mail volume. But in that time, we would have turned a $1 billion profit if it was not for some mandates that we've got with Congress that need to be addressed this year.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive. Things just don't happen. You need a plan. A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee for your benefit. Presented by NITP has the answers to your mid-career and retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit Mondays at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio for an hour that can change your future.
The possibility of an invisibility cloak is a step closer to reality. Engineers are now able to fabricate large pieces of a material with very unique properties. Engineers like John Rogers at the University of Illinois are creating so-called metamaterials, structured to play tricks with light.
The hope is that you could engineer a material like that to bend light in such a way that it sort of moves around an object and creates a level of invisibility.
Until now, those structures have been vanishingly small themselves, but Rogers has devised a way to print large sheets of a promising metamaterial
so that you can create enough of it that you can begin to think about engineering applications of these structures.
Rogers says more work is needed for an invisibility cloak, but this new printing method may already allow advances in communication and imaging systems. For more, go to www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
How can government executives drive performance in a cutback climate? What are the latest best practices for tackling today's human capital challenges? Join OPM Director John Berry and hundreds of federal managers to learn how to achieve more with less at Excellence in Government, July 11th. Register today for early bird rates. www.excelgov.com. www.excelgov.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Every week at 3 o'clock on Friday, two people who are experts in the world of the federal government choose the three most important federal news stories of the week, rank them in order, and then come in the studio and talk to me about them on the Federal News Countdown. We've got them all posted for you at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. My experts this week are Rob Burton from Venable and Julie Myers-Wood of INC Solutions. And Julie, your story number two in the countdown is headlined, Congressional Budget Office Warns of Debt Explosion. It's from the Washington Post. And I mentioned during the break, I listened to this hearing at which the director of the Congressional Budget Office testified about this report. And the numbers are just, they just blow your mind when you really consider the impact in the next, this is not, you know, 50, 75 years either. This is 10 to 15 years from now, the kind of situation that we could find ourselves in.
That's right. I mean, we appear to be seeing having a real kind of near-term crisis, and we can see that by kind of all the talks on raising the debt limit and then the report from the CBO and other things, and there are not a lot of good solutions. And so for me, this story was the second most important story of the week for federal employees because there's not a lot of willingness to cut in some of the big, you know, pet areas, Social Security, Medicare, insurance subsidies. And there are going to be really draconian cuts to other parts and other agencies in the government, the Department of Commerce, other places. And so I think federal employees need to be thinking about that's going to be coming sooner rather than later. And maybe the future that they expected as a government employee may not be the one that they're going to get unless some of these broader issues are resolved.
Rob, the paragraph in this story that bothered me the most, Democrats have ruled out major changes to health and retirement programs, while Republicans have ruled out any increases in tax revenue.
It serves like stalemate.
Yeah. I mean, talk about button heads. I mean, that's any economist that has looked at this that I think has a decent reputation says it's going to be some of both. There will have to be sizable cuts, and there will have to be, in some cases, substantial tax increases to be able to do this. It's what a family does when they go heavily into debt and are trying to pull themselves back together. They cut spending way back, and they do whatever they can to increase revenue, to increase the amount of money coming in. It just seems to make sense, and yet we're in this situation that became very clear at this hearing this week.
Well, two things that concern me, Francis, about this whole thing is one, you're right, the unwillingness to cut programs. I do think that it might be more doable to target things other than health and retirement programs because there seems to be they're sacred. Now, that's where all the money is, I know. But it seems like we could start maybe more modestly and just target some wasteful programs that if we could get everybody to agree on what they are. That's the problem. But politically, that might be easier than taking on health and retirement, which nobody wants to touch. But, boy, there are a lot of other programs that could be cut and save billions, and maybe that's where Congress should start. The reality is, cuts are inevitable because we cannot continue like this. I think everybody would agree with that. Mm-hmm. The other thing, Francis, that bothers me about this is the fact Congress may raise the debt limit. Now, you know exactly what's going to happen. If they raise the debt limit, everybody's going to say, wow, we're off the hook for a little while. Let's just keep on spending because the debt ceiling has been raised. I think it would be a real mistake to raise the debt ceiling because that's the only thing right now sort of forcing people to seriously look at cuts.
You're not worried about the potential for default or for interest rate through the roof, those kinds of things that some economists have talked about?
I mean, that's a possibility, but I think that just keep raising the debt limit just going to make the problem worse.
But I do think that the Appropriations Committee, kind of on the Senate and the House side, are starting to ask some of these departments to make more serious cuts than they have in the past and to look at that. And so I think it's some of the places that are not most critical to Homeland Security. DHS has been a little bit lucky. It's escaped some of it. But in agencies and departments that are not viewed as critical to Homeland Security, they're going to have some severe cuts kind of even in the next year, very likely, and long term, given this debt explosion. You know, they don't have a very kind of glowing forecast for growth and expansion of even some very good and legitimate programs that may not be core to our federal work.
Well, the agencies, though, sometimes have the same problems that Congress does, and that is giving up jurisdiction of something that maybe isn't their core jurisdiction. I mean, you know better than anybody else, maybe than people that are listening, how many committees have jurisdiction over DHS and the various components. The congressional committees don't want to give up that jurisdiction and consolidate, and the agencies aren't in a big hurry to say, well, Agency X is doing this a little bit better than us, and it fits their core mission better. We'll give that one away. They don't want to do it.
Absolutely. It's going to be incredibly tough. And what we've seen from some of the earlier kind of budget cuts that agencies have been asked to make is they've done things like say, well, we will reduce the number of commemorative challenge coins, which may be terrific, but it's not going to be a very substantial kind of cost-saving measure.
Yeah.
And so I think folks, particularly at folks that are not at DOD and Homeland Security, need to look really hard, you know, which grant programs are most essential, which particular things are most essential, and which ones, you know, maybe are ones that we can trim back or be more efficient with what we have or do without.
But then we go back to Congress, and you have to convince them that they're going to have to figure out a way to go back to their district or their state and say, well, I didn't bring home the bacon on this particular issue this time, so we're not getting that money for that whatever it is anymore.
That's exactly right. So you know, even if the agencies decide that on their own, and many times the money is directed towards a certain source or there's congressional pressure to be using it in a certain area. But I think, to me, this article just said we can't put off this problem any longer. So, you know, regardless of what they're doing on the kind of the debt limit ceiling, regardless of the other things, they're going to be extensive, long-term, serious cuts that are going to affect really every federal employee.
Julie Myers Wood's story number two in the countdowns from the Washington Post. The headline is Congressional Budget Office Warns of Debt Explosion. We have the story linked up, and through the story you can find the CBO report that was discussed at this hearing, which is pretty bracing. National debt will exceed the size of the entire U.S. economy by 2021 and balloon to nearly 200% of GDP within 25 years. It's pretty heady stuff, and you can read it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We're up to story number one from Rob Burton and from Julie Myers Wood on the Federal News Countdown on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
NBC News Radio, I'm Pete Williams. Actor Peter Falk has died. He was best known as the rumpled police detective Lieutenant Columbo, his television role in the 1970s.
Oh, sir, just one more thing.
Peter Falk died in Beverly Hills yesterday. He was 83. The Souris River is flowing over most of the levees in Minot, North Dakota. NBC's Janelle Klein says it has already surged over the record set 130 years ago.
They are now expecting six times more water than these levees were designed to protect.
And the river is expected to rise another 6 feet by this weekend. The House has voted to reject a measure described as giving President Obama the authority to continue the U.S. military operation in Libya, but a separate vote to cut off funding failed. And the price of gasoline has fallen almost 10% since early May. A decision to release strategic oil supplies has sent oil prices tumbling and could lower gas prices another 20 cents by next weekend. More at MSNBC.com. I'm Pete Williams, NBC News Radio.
Here's another question from the Geico Savings Mailbag.
Jason from Buffalo writes, I have a habit of hitting snooze and not being able to get up again. Any suggestions?
You know, if you get Geico to help with your renter's insurance, it's quite easy, really. You'll know you're protecting your stuff for as little as $12 a month, which I suspect will make you sleep much sounder. Then you'll just pop out of bed rested, ready to start your day.
What he's saying is, a renter's policy is basically insurance for your snooze button.
Plus most everything else you own.
Visit Geico.com to see how affordable renter's insurance can be.
If you're thinking about selling your car, the first place you should go is CarMax. At CarMax, we'll buy your car, even if you don't buy a car from us. And it couldn't be easier. Just bring in your car and we'll appraise it for free and give you a written offer that's good for 7 days. So you can think it over or sell it right away. If it's time to sell your car, do it the easy way. Just bring it into CarMax today. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Profile America, Friday, June 24th. It's said that Americans will race anything from each other on foot, in the water, on bicycles and skis, to horseback and sailboats. When it comes to engine-powered racing, we race aircraft, motorcycles, cars, and even lawnmowers. But there's nothing quite like the event coming up today and tomorrow in Emerson, Arkansas. The 21st annual Purple Hull Pea Festival will host the World Championship Rotary Tiller Races. Kelby Nelson of Junction City, Arkansas, was a repeat champion last year, covering the 200-foot track in just over 10 seconds, well off the world record. Most rotary tillers lead a more mundane life, stirring up the ground for gardens all across the country. More than one in five U.S. households has a vegetable garden. Profile America is in its 15th year as a public service of the U.S. Census Bureau.
Everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
Join us next Sunday, June 26th. We'll be talking with the Fancy Food Show. They're coming to D.C. and they're coming in studio. And R.J. Cooper's new restaurant, Road 24, is opening. We're going to get the 411.
Fancy Food Show. I should probably stay home. But whatever, that's Foodie and the Beast next Sunday and every Sunday live at 11 right here on 1500 and 820 a.m.
Newsmakers on the Federal Drive.
Postmaster General Patrick Donahoe.
We are going to lose money again this year for two reasons. First of all, just like the economy, our revenue's down. There's economic pressure on us, plus electronic diversion, people paying bills online. And over the last 4 years, we've experienced a 20% drop in mail volume. But in that time, we would have turned a $1 billion profit if it was not for some mandates that we've got with Congress that need to be addressed this year.
Hear the entire interview online. FederalNewsRadio.com/Federal Drive.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week, featuring Rob Burton and Julie Myers Wood, and we're up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week, as chosen by Julie Myers Wood, is the GAO report that we talked about this week on In Depth. Pentagon must provide better training for new Cyber Command security system. Cyber Command, of course, being stood up at Fort Meade, right alongside the National Security Agency. And I thought this was particularly timely in light of some of the attacks that we've seen, cyber attacks on contractors with the tremendous amount, especially of intellectual property that the federal government relies on.
That's right. I think over the last couple of months, we've just seen kind of what seems to, appears to be an increasing number of cyber attacks on government entities, you know, defense contractors, and even Sony. And I think the big question, and what the GAO report is hitting on some part, is are we ready for it? And it's kind of a really scary thing that, to think that we're not ready to really deal with these hackers and the hackers that have these various motives. You know, some just want money, and that's what we've kind of traditionally thought of. People are hacking in to get money. Others, these, you know, hacktivists that are going in it for the, with this political view. And then finally, I think of probably most concern to DOD and other places are, you know, state-sponsored entities. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that other foreign countries could want to get in, get to our sensitive secrets.
Well, I think what's maybe more dangerous than that, too, is the idea that nation states have figured out that they can get make themselves appear, at least, to be immune from any retaliation by us or whoever it is that they're attacking by setting up, maybe even in some cases, shell groups that are actually funded and so on by the nation state, but aren't them, and break into our systems or contractor systems or whatever.
That's right. And anything that relies on kind of government IT and IT kind of expertise is a little bit troubling to think about that being kind of the savior. So I have, you know, great hope in, you know, the Cyber Command and some of the other things that are being done, that we really get kind of the best and the brightest that are in and continue to join the government to fight this, because this is going to be an ongoing challenge.
Do you think, Rob, that the contractors are finally waking up to what they're losing, especially in IP?
Well, I don't know. I don't know, Franz. That's a good question. I think there is a realization that the government has enormous rights, you know, when it comes to IP.
Mm-hmm.
And they take the rights.
Mm-hmm.
And they do. Actually, I know some contractors that have not dealt with the federal government. They don't want to do business with the federal government because of this very issue.
Mm-hmm.
They're very worried about losing their proprietary data rights.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the answer to your question is yes.
Yeah, I'm becoming a target for this kind of thing where a company breaks in. And it's been Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, L3 are the big ones that we've heard about recently where their networks have been penetrated and information's been taken out of there to go who knows where.
Well, and when you think about what happened with, RSA Secure ID tokens,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's what, you know, I used in the government for a number of years. And, you know, those were kind of very commonly used. And so to think that the disruption to that system is also very troubling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing I've learned, Francis, I've been in the private sector, is that there really are some innovative technologies out there that the government simply is not using. I don't understand why. But I have certainly learned that there are capabilities in the cybersecurity arena that the government's not really effectively utilizing. So hopefully that will change. I'll tell you what made me really nervous was this article in combination to another one that talked about that the security clearances are being granted for folks where they shouldn't be granted.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, we even have government security folks that are not conducting the background investigations. They just say, yeah, he looks good to me. And they're faking it, and they're not even making calls or checking references. That's very troubling, especially in light of some of the cybersecurity threats we're facing.
Well, that's a conversation that I have whenever I talk to chief human capital officers, not specifically about clearances, but just about the whole idea of trying to compress the hiring timeline. I understand you want to make it shorter than it is now, but if you hire somebody in 40 days or 30 days or 10 days and they're terrible for the job, you're further behind than when you started, and that's especially true in security clearances.
That's absolutely true, and that's what I think the Border Patrol and CBP is really seeing, all the corruption that has occurred within kind of Border Patrol for this quick hiring, the
mm-hmm.
pressure to get kind of boots on the ground, but you need those to be boots that are non-corrupt boots that are really there for the right reason and aren't going to be kind of easily bribed. So it's a challenge all around.
Sure. I would think that if you were corrupt, that would be a terrific opportunity to get hired by CBP and be in a position where you could just not see things, so to speak.
That's absolutely right. And of course, CBP is working hard, ICE, DHS, IG, everybody working hard to prevent that. But I think the rush to hire does sometimes, you know, compromise the security clearance process.
Where do you think this goes, Julie? Do you think eventually that Cyber Command will make a big difference when it comes to securing DOD?
It's got to. I think all the articles that have been this week, not only here, but Wall Street Journal, other places, kind of talking about these repeated attacks, shows it's absolutely essential.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it does concern me to think that the government's not using the most innovative technologies because we have the most important secrets to protect. So I hope that, you know, some of the very bright men and women over there are going to be thinking about how can we leverage the private sector more effectively, and that the private sector folks are also thinking how can we protect, you know, kind of our needs as well.
Yeah.
Because if not, you know, we're going to be in a world of hurt.
Julie Myers Wood's story number one on the Federal News Countdown this week is about the GAO report about the Pentagon providing cyber training at Cyber Command. And you can read about it and read the GAO report at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Rob Burton's number one story to wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown when we continue on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Do you know us? You count on our technology every day. The office elevator that takes you up and down efficiently. The jet engine that gets you home safely. The fire suppression system you hope you never need, but know is there. You count on things we make to protect you from harm, and even to keep you cool and comfortable. Our technologies are a critical part of your everyday life. Yet many people don't even know who we are. Our name is United Technologies. We are Carrier, Hamilton Sunstrand, Otis, Pratt & Whitney, Sikorsky, and UTC Fire and Security. Six businesses united as one powerful company. In fact, we are one of the largest manufacturers in the United States, which likely makes us the biggest company you've never heard of, even though you depend on us every single day. United Technologies. Get to know more about us at UTC.com.
The Government IT Solutions Spotlight is brought to you by CDWG.
The General Services Administration is testing a new approach with 70 vendors to speed up offers and contract modifications under the federal supply schedule. GSA has long discussed the idea of e-offers and e-modifications. Under this pilot, vendors are working out the bugs of the new systems. Patricia Waddell is GSA's Deputy Director for Schedule 70. She says GSA will expand the pilot to other vendors later this year and plans to take the e-offers and e-modification systems live in 2012.
If you're in federal IT, you know the pressure to maximize your agency's IT investment. Visit cdwg.com/datacenter to see how our experts have helped federal agencies virtualize, optimize, consolidate their data centers, and reduce ROI pressure. CDWG, people who get it.
Visit cdwg.com to learn how you can achieve the benefits of private clouds with a VCE V-Block solution from EMC, Cisco, and VMware.
Diary entry, August 15th. My joints ache. Today I can hardly move. I need some answers.
September 3rd. I'm tired all the time. What's going on?
June 8th. I woke up with a rash on my face. I want to know why.
For answers, ask your doctor the right question. Could I have lupus? For answers, for support, for hope, visit couldihavelupus.gov or call 1-800-994-9662. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health and the Ad Council.
The Performance Improvement Council, in partnership with the Department of Defense, would like to invite all federal employees to this year's Performance Symposium in Lansdowne, Virginia, June 27th through the 30th. The symposium will feature sessions led by leaders from across the federal government. Focus areas include performance, strategy, budget, and more. Spots are filling up fast. Please go to live.i6sigma.com to register with the code FEDERAL2011 or email info@pic.gov for more information.
We're back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown. This week it's Julie Myers Wood and Rob Burton selecting the stories that they believe are the three most important federal news stories of the week to count down on the Federal News Countdown. And Rob Burton, your story number one is headlined, House Committee Passes Data Transparency Bill. And I seem to have, what do you got there? The number one story is ISA introduces bill to reform Postal Service. I had my story screwed up. But leave it to me to mess up the number one story of the week. The Postal Service responded to this yesterday, Rob, and I thought their reaction was very interesting because what I read between the lines, correct me if you think I'm wrong, was, we got this and we don't really need your help. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. But I think this is really interesting, Francis, because the Postal Service is sort of a what went wrong? Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of what went wrong. We do know, and these are frightening statistics, that they lost $2.2 billion in the second quarter of this fiscal year, and it's projected they're going to lose at least another $8.3 billion by the end of the fiscal year on September 30th. So I give Congressman Issa's committee credit for trying to address a problem, but I'm not sure what the solution is, and I'm not sure they've got the right solution here. This is sort of a debate, Francis, between more regulation and less regulation. Really, the committee is saying we think we need to have more oversight, more regulation, because these people have just got it wrong. And we were joking earlier about setting up new boards and so forth. So we're going to have a new one under this legislation called the Postal Service Financial Responsibility and Management Assistance Authority.
Congressman Issa loves his acronyms, doesn't he?
Well, that's going to be a fun acronym. I'm not sure what it is, but it's going to have an acronym. Because that's a long title. The problem is you're talking about more regulation with this assistance authority. And Postal Service, like you said, Francis, they responded, I think this is great. They basically said, look, the reason we're in such a mess is because we're already overregulated. And what we need to do is act more like a commercial entity. Give us the flexibility. Allow us to have less regulation and act like a commercial entity, and then we will do better financially. Interesting. It's sort of the debate.
Let me read you an editorial that is along these lines that I think is really interesting. This says, many find mail in paper form to be quaint. It no longer plays a central role in society. That's a passage from an editorial in the Globe and Mail, which is a newspaper in Toronto, as Canada Post, the Canadian Postal Service, is now in the third week of a workers' strike. And this story from the Christian Science Monitor says that 3 weeks after the strike began, lawmakers are preparing to legislate them back to work, the postal workers. But Canadians are asking just how much a modern, cyber-connected society needs the post office anyway. If I get my mail, I get my mail. But if I really have to do something, I go on the internet, says Janina, a bank teller. And it goes on to detail this issue that Canadians are wrestling with, just the same as we're wrestling with, of really, how relevant is the Postal Service, and what does a Postal Service for the 21st century look like? And I'm not sure that people in our Postal Service, and especially the employees in the Postal Service, really understand what they're up against.
Well, I think that's, I think one thing is inevitable. We're going to go to 5-day mail as opposed to 6-day mail because everybody seems to agree with that, including the Postal Service. Congress now seems to be willing to go with that and the Postal Service as well. But the Postal Service has said, Francis, that one reason they're having financial trouble is the dramatic decrease in volume of mail.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right. Will we need a postal service 20 years from now? I don't know.
The concept, too, a friend of mine who is involved in the government but doesn't have anything to do with the postal service made the observation of, what is the difference of me, when I need to pick up my mail, going to the post office to pick it up as opposed to going to the store to buy a gallon of milk when I need a gallon of milk? I have to go somewhere to get it. It's not delivered right to my house anymore. Nothing's really delivered to your house anymore except packages.
Right, and I think there'll always be a need for that.
And there will be a business model for the Postal Service to do that. What's killing them is having to go to everybody's house every day to every address in the United States of America, and that's what they're having a hard time getting off of. What do you think when you see this, all of these things that the Postal Service is going through, Julie?
Oh, I think you raised kind of some excellent points about kind of the challenge and how much we are relying now not on the Postal Service. And I know how rare it is for my 4.5-year-old to get mail.
Yeah.
And how excited he is when he actually gets a real letter. So there's something nice about that. But could that be sent by FedEx or by UPS or by DHL, depending on where you are? Of course it could. And so I think moving to a 5-day model makes sense. Moving to other models that are more economically competitive makes sense. We can't afford to subsidize the Postal Service in this way anymore.
It's fascinating stuff. It's Rob Burton's story number one on the Federal News Countdown. You can find it on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. A terrific Federal News Countdown as always. It's great to see both of you. Thank you for coming in, Julie Myers-Wood and Rob Burton.
Good seeing you.
Federal News Countdown is back next Friday at 3.